Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to The Ooze. My name's T.C. Downey, and with me on the air is Lehi. Lehi, how are you doing today, my man?
I'm doing quite well. I'm just finishing my coffee, getting energized for this open discussion. What have you been up to, T.C.?
Right on. Oh, man, it's been a fucking hectic-ass 24 hours. I set off early in the evening to pick up my son last night, and I didn't manage to actually make it back to my house till about 1 a.m. We had a, there's about 20, 30-mile section of completely black highway between where my kid lives and where I actually live, and so even though the entire trip is more like about, 130 miles, it just so happens that we had a tire blowout right in that completely black section, the 30-mile-an-hour section. And the one thing I didn't realize was that my brother's not smart enough to keep a flashlight in the car, so.
Oh.
Try changing a tire in the pitch black.
No thanks. That sounds not fun. Well, what did it blow out on?
What's that?
What did it blow out on?
It just blew out. I guess it was the only tire that he hadn't replaced since he bought the car, and the sidewall just popped out. Just boom. We were doing about 75 miles an hour, and the rear passenger side tire just went kaboom. It's kind of weird, actually, because our speed... when the tire did actually pop, the car didn't immediately, like, drop down. Instead, because of how quick we were going and the fact that it's such a small car, it was literally, like, I don't know, maybe another mile up the road after the tire actually popped before we even realized what that sound was, when it started making the sound like, you know, flat tire. And we were like, oh, shit, that's what that was.
You know, one time I was driving home from work, and I'm driving behind some truck, and something fell out of it. And all of a sudden, I hear my back tire go bump, 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 bump. I'm like, oh, shit. So I pull over, and what had happened was a pair of needle-nose pliers fell out of the back of the truck, and the handle jammed itself into the tire.
Ow. So
yeah.
That went boom.
Yeah, it was crazy.
It was just strange. He drives this little, I can't think of what actual kind of car it is, but it's a little Hyundai. It's just this very, very small, like, economy car. And so it's interesting in a couple of facets because, like I said, it was literally almost a mile before the tire that had blown actually even touched the road enough to make the sound to let us know we had had a blown tire. It was really kind of weird in that aspect. And then another thing that was strange was most of the time when you get the lugs off and the tire's up far enough off the ground, it's pretty easy or relatively easy to go ahead and remove the actual rim and put your spare on. Well, his fucking, the hub for the tire didn't want to let go of the rim.
Ooh.
So it, yeah, so that made it even more interesting. It was like trying to find something to wedge into it to pop it off. And as it was, you know, pitch black, so we couldn't see shit to really see what the hell was going on. I mean, we're using cell phones to try to light the actual scene so we can at least get somewhat of an idea of what's going on. But hopefully this year he'll treat himself to a flashlight and not have such trouble in the future.
Yeah. I've got one more. I know this has nothing to do with LHP, but I got one more story about a pop tire. I think I was like 16 or 17, and me and my buddies took my friend's mom's Montero. And I was living at Utah at the time, and we decided to drive up some canyon, like, behind the mountains. And, you know, the roads are kind of rough, and he decided to drive like a maniac, so... we hit a fucking rock, and it popped the tire on the back. And turns out we didn't have a jack.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah, like, we're in the middle of nowhere, no one's around, no jack. So what we did was, first we took the Montero and we found like a big mound, and we propped up the front tire. We propped the front tire up on it so that the back tire was hanging off. And that was one way to get it up off the ground. And the other problem is the tire we had, we only had a part of it, so it was hard to get leverage to fucking turn on the lug nuts. So, like, we got, like, rope and sticks and, like, jammed it through, and it was a pain in the ass, but we got that thing changed out.
Yeah, it sounds like that was a major pain in the ass. You know, before the show, we were talking a little bit about chili, and I was making mention that my recipe actually was taught to me when I was 10 years old by a woman who at that time had been the Kentucky State Chili Champion for the Kentucky State Fair for 10 years straight. And I got to really thinking to myself in a way that it would probably have been my first real exposure to what someone might consider an oral tradition of sorts. And I thought it might be kind of cool if we talked a little bit about the idea of what an oral tradition is.
That sounds like an interesting topic. So you got your first one with a cooking recipe, and it sounds like a hell of a cooking recipe if you got it from a champion.
Yeah, it definitely a hell of a cooking recipe. What's interesting about the recipe is that there's not really an exact measurements that are done. Most of the actual development and of the taste of this particular pot of chili is done through personal preference and through kind of sampling each flavor in its place as it's going. So as you're building up to, you know, this final kind of taste sensation, it takes a degree of understanding of your own taste buds to complete it. So I always thought that part was really cool because it's not a recipe that you can really write down. There is a suggested, like, outline of what you purchase in the store. You know, like, you'll get this much of that. But by all means, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to use it all.
Right. So somebody can give you a prescription on how to do it. But the real good stuff comes from experience.
It comes from the experience. That's
chili.
Right. It comes from a hands-on, it's kind of a hands-on passing of experience is what I think is the most fascinating part of this chili recipe. That it's not just teaching you what tastes right. It's teaching you to recognize what tastes good to you and how, taste is affected one way or the other. So, you know, this is where you get developments like this new mango habanero sauce that I've seen people using a lot lately. It's something that's been around for a while, but the taste has finally been developed to a point that is very interesting. It's got that sweet and spicy along with a little bit of a tart to it.
Mmm, sounds tasty.
Yeah, so.
You know, it kind of makes me wonder, though, about, like, when you're talking about oral traditions and whatnot and getting the best from experience from actually interacting with a person and actually doing the thing, what I have to think about is, you know, on the internet, the story's a little bit different. There's so much information out there. You can learn anything you want on the internet. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of crap that you have to dig through to get the gold. But, you know, and there's a lot of things I've taught myself from the internet, but it doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense, like, until you actually do it. And that's one thing you don't get online a whole lot. I guess you can kind of get it when we have, like, say, this radio show. We have a dialogue going, and you know, maybe if we were on the phone, we could, like, tell each other how to do something. But I would say it's not the same as in-person, one-on-one interaction where somebody's passing down knowledge and can guide you through it. Unless you make
I think it's actually how we develop the idea of the teacher or the mentor as a human species itself goes. Somebody along the way said, wait a minute, you know, it's not enough to just give the information. You have to kind of guide the experience too. And, you know, allow that experience itself to develop into a deeper gnosis of information, a deeper knowledge, if I can say that with a capital K, and everybody kind of understand what I mean by that.
Right. It's real knowledge. It's something you actually know rather than just spewing facts back.
Right. And that's also kind of funny because that wraps back around to what the discussion last night between my brother and I was. After we got the tire changed out, knowing we still had about 80 miles to go, and we weren't going to be going over 45, 50 miles an hour now, we decided we'd start kind of talking. And my brother is a militant anti-theist. That's what he calls himself. In other words, he's an atheist who's hell-bent on convincing theists that they're just out of their tree.
I mean, along the line of Hitchens?
Oh, he's worse than Hitchens. He really is.
That's interesting.
But, yeah, it's really kind of funny because to me, I see the value of theism. You know, and I understand the value of personal assessment, where to my brother, it's more important that it be in line with said fact, or it be scientifically proven. That's the way that he makes his distinctions and judgments. And so it's kind of weird when you put the two of us together, because I can totally get where he's coming from, but he can't do the same for me. Like, he has no idea when I start talking about the value of experience. He has no idea how to relate with it, because as far as he's concerned, experience is something that's attained through reading academic papers and trusting the experts, so to speak.
Wow, that's, you know, that's kind of ironic, considering a lot of people who call themselves atheists tend to claim to be open-minded and rational, but it sounds kind of like he's a little closed-minded to some things.
He's very closed-minded to some things. To give you an idea, he considers astrophysics to be a hard science. Like astrophysics is completely provable. In his mind, you know, people who have telescopes, they have all these electronic instruments that go out there and make these proposed measurements, and then they can draw absolute facts from these measurements. Well, one of the things that we got to discussing last night was a thing I like to call proximity to origin. Now, what this means to me is that the further what you're dealing with is from you, the harder it is to make a determined judgment, because you lose empirical information that is divulged to you through experiencing these things. And now, what that means is that since we can never physically witness the explosion of a red dwarf, or those the ones that explode?
A what?
The red dwarf star, are those the ones that explode?
Do red dwarfs explode?
What's that?
Red dwarfs explode?
I think so. I may or may not be accurate on that, but the point of what I'm saying is that because we can never witness it, we can never be there to actually experience it, we don't really know that even really happens. We make educated guesses based on certain proximities and values.
Right. I mean, if you think about science, one thing people tend to forget is that science gets a lot of information from induction, and there is no 100% certainty. You can get pretty damn close to 100%, but there's always room to be proven wrong. And that's really how it's supposed to work, is you try to prove each other's shit wrong when it comes to scientists doing discoveries. You're trying to prove something wrong. You're not trying to prove something right. You're trying to eliminate everything you can. But people
tend to... Right, and Go ahead. Lehigh?
Yeah.
Let's see, go ahead and finish. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, I did finish.
Okay. What's interesting to me, it's something that I don't think that most people are aware of, but science itself is a philosophy. And it's kind of born from natural philosophy, is actually its grandparent, so to speak. So it's always very interesting to me, because all the philosophy really suggests is that it's a coherent way of doing something. You know, you can have a philosophy on how to sell books. You can have a philosophy on how to make a more realistic picture. You can have a philosophy on scientific method. But overall, it's a philosophy, and so with different types of philosophies, new types of developments happen. So I just always think it's really interesting, because people tend to think of science as its own separate, like, hard, dogmatic, axiom-based rule set, and I think science is far from that. It's, again, it's a philosophy. It's something that... as the views within your world parameters change, so will your views within the particular study you're doing.
Right, and so, and even when you get down to scientists trying to do their discoveries and experiments, sometimes it's not true that they always go through a scientific method, so to speak. Yeah, there is this thing we call the scientific method. But how many people actually go through that method, and is there a standard method? I don't think there is a standard method that that every scientist follows. Sometimes they just go by their intuition. I mean, I've heard of instances of discoveries being made when, like, I can't remember what the name of the dude was, and what he discovered. But there's one instance where the guy had a dream about the solution to the problem he was working on. I mean, there's many different ways to get to these answers. Yeah, you can be rigorous in testing it out after the fact, but sometimes they make their discoveries not by the way everyone thinks they do. It's more fluid.
Right. Well, what's interesting about science is it's another example of an oral tradition. It's something that we've tried very hard to mechanize, but in itself, you don't make any real gains until you have that knowledge with a capital K, and until you've reached that gnosis, you really don't have any insight, and it's hard to move past in a very abstract fashion. I think that's why it's always important to kind of notice when things are getting to be abstract and to work to move away from that. Abstraction in itself, it doesn't really have the rooting that it needs in practical means.
Right, I think that makes the case the importance of not just internships, but what's it called? Apprenticeships. I guess that's kind of the same thing. But when you can study in school all you want, but you really have to get in there and learn from somebody who's been doing it, and you have to do it yourself.
Right. I think it's interesting that the most influential positions, or what we as a common person consider to be the most influential type careers, are all practices. And if people practice law, they practice medicine. These things are kind of revered, and we often kind of think of them as being one notch above whatever other trades or crafts we have. Like, who the hell would you rather have with you shipwrecked on an island, somebody who designed a video game or somebody who practices medicine?
Yeah, it's a lot more valuable. Medicine is, it's a life or death kind of thing.
Right, but is it more valuable? I mean, when you look at somebody just from their creative aptitudes, just from their ability to solve problems, isn't necessarily the case that the person who practices medicine will have a better ability of solving problems than the person who invented a particular style of video game or something.
That's a good question. Because there's a lot of thought that goes into the video game on problem solving. In fact, there's probably a lot more mathematical problems that a video game designer has to deal with than... I can't really say as much for the doctor. I guess it really depends on what you're doing in the medical field.
Right. I think just like every other field, you have different grades according to the level of complexity or creativity in problem solving. That's why you have people who specialize in particular fields that they practice. And one good example might be a optometrist.
A what?
An optometrist.
Oh, optometrist. Gotcha.
Yeah. I'm just giving one example. It's the first one that came to my mind. But that they have a better ability, or at least they feel they have a better ability of solving problems that are due specifically with the field that they're correlating to. So it kind of in itself becomes a narrow practice, and I think that that's something else that, I don't know, I'm kind of skeptical in, someone who builds too strongly in one direction or the other, if that makes sense.
If somebody specializes, that means they're probably not necessarily good in very many other things. It's kind of like you got an idiot savant. They're really, really good at one thing, but complete retards in every other aspect. I mean, I know that's extreme, but I think that demonstrates the point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I don't know. I guess I'm just kind of getting to the idea that it is better to have a fair amount of knowledge of everything than to have all of the knowledge of any one particular thing.
Hold on a second, TC.
Sure. Stranger says what?
My guest has arrived.
Awesome.
So I will probably bring her on when she comes inside. She's smoking a cigarette. Anyway, what were you saying?
I was saying that I think that it is better to have a fair amount of knowledge over a vast number of subjects than it is to have all knowledge or complete knowledge of any one specific subject.
Cool. Yeah, I like being a jack of all trades. It's kind of hard. Like in today's world, everyone's looking for a specialist to do something fast and amazing. But you know, I kind of find myself in this jack of all trades positions where I can do a lot of different things, and I'm not like an expert in any of them, but I can do them. So I mean, would you think that's more valuable? Because I guess it would show a certain amount of mental flexibility.
Yeah, I just think that's more valuable, absolutely. One of the things that we were discussing last night was the fact that he posed this question to me when I said, what the hell good does an astrophysicist do me? And he posed this question like this. He said, let's say you wanted to buy a pair of shoes. Would you rather buy a pair of shoes from somebody who just on a whim decided to learn about how to make them and make them, or somebody who had been trained in it and then after that dedicated their entire life to making them? And I sat there and I scratched my head for a minute and I said, wait a minute. The problem when somebody does something like that is they typically tend to specialize. They tend to become very focused on one particular aspect. So when you go to this guy who's been making shoes for, I don't know, his entire existence, he might have a different idea of the shoe than you do. He might have in his mind, oh, this is the ideal shoe for your foot, and ignore the, you know, other things that make the shoe desirable to you. It's aesthetics, it's maybe it's ease of use. Where somebody who just had learned out of necessity to make a shoe might be more creative and able to integrate other technologies that they've learned to give you more flexibility in the shoes.
That makes sense. Yeah, I guess another point is that when somebody specializes, I guess we already made this point, but when somebody specializes, yeah, for one, you're saying that they don't have insights from, they're thinking very much inside the box, like, and not just inside the box, but in a little part of the box. Whereas somebody coming from another field that may not know how to do it may have other ideas they can use. It's kind of interesting when you think about when Ford came up with the assembly line idea for cars. Guess where he got the idea from?
I actually don't know the answer to that. Where did he get the idea from?
He noticed that when he went to butcheries that they kind of had an assembly line kind of deal going on, different people doing different parts of the job to make it more efficient. And he took that idea from that meat industry and he brought it over into automotive and revolutionized the automotive industry.
Right, right, because now it became less expensive and less cumbersome to make cars and make them in mass so we could offer them at lower prices. I mean, it's actually funny. I've had a lot of conversations as of recently with people who are actually convinced that Ford is the one who invented the car. But there were cars in the 1800s, if you can imagine, in the mid-1800s.
No, he just came up with the automotive assembly line.
Yeah, I mean, when you sit and think about that, I mean, at the same time that we're picturing Billy the Kid and the Pony Express, that people were actually making wagons with motors on them and driving them.
All right, so my friend Jen's in here. Want to say hi, Jen?
Hi, Jen.
Sure.
You're on the ooze.
Hi, Jen.
I'm on the ooze.
Welcome to the ooze, Jen.
So we were just talking about specialization and oral traditions. Do you have any oral traditions that you learned, any skill sets?
I was going to make a cocksucking joke, but I don't think that's appropriate.
Oh, it's very appropriate. Come on, this is the ooze.
Well, that's usually what happens after I suck.
I missed that last little bit of commentary.
Oh. Which part, where did it cut off for you?
Oh, at what her actual oral tradition was.
Oh.
I said the second cock count as an oral tradition.
If you were taught how to do it, absolutely.
Wasn't so much taught as it was lots and lots of practice.
This is what we're talking about, is the value of actually doing something rather than reading about it. No one ever learned how to suck a cock by reading about it.
Yeah, seriously. You just got to get yourself fucking out there and just suck a lot of dick until you get it right.
I approve of this message.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
So I kind of forgot... where we were at before that, I think we were talking about cars and specialization.
Yeah, I was just making the point that when you specialize something, you narrow the field, and that, in my opinion, it would be better to get the video game designer who has to have more intricate knowledge of a broader range of subjects than it would be to have a physician on board with me if we were shipwrecked on an island. That would just be my preference.
Right. The designer might actually be able to help you build stuff to survive or come up with unique solutions. Because that's what they do, a lot of that. It's tough stuff. It really is. I mean, I'm trying to learn programming myself, and it's difficult. You have to have a very flexible mind to create these things.
Right, absolutely. So it's just interesting when you line all of this stuff up with the tire blowout and then the bullet chili, we actually come up with enough content to fill over half the show. It just kind of cracks me up in that way.
Yeah, we're just good like that because we're not specialized.
No, it's trying not to be. So I think that that's certainly, you know, something that I would put up for anybody who's interested in, you know, debating the idea. Not necessarily just on this show, but on any open discussion that we hold here on the news, you could call in and bring up this topic, and we'll go at it here. Again, I guess I should throw in the call-in number. It's 347-989-1371 if you want to call in and you have something you want to discuss. Today's open discussion, so anything goes. As you could tell from Lehi's friend Jen, who wanted to share her practices.
Oh, yes. She's, I from what I hear, she's very skilled.
Right on. So, you know, I mean, in that, maybe, you know, she could start her own religion, the religion of phallic worship.
Yes, I think you should do that, Jen.
I think I will. I'll spread the gospel tonight.
Yes.
Start your gospel tonight.
Spread the seed of the gospel.
Spread the gospel, spreading seed.
So, anyhow,
I don't think we'll have any biters today. Is there anything in particular that you've experienced this week that you thought might be relevant to what we were talking about, or maybe just you wanted to bring up?
That's a good question. As far as oral traditions, I haven't done anything recently that has to do with that. I mean, I've been trying to teach, like I was saying before, I'm trying to teach myself certain things having to do with computers and programming, and it's pretty hard. I've been going to a lot of different forums and looking up different kinds of software, and you know, I guess as far as websites go, like website building, I could call myself a script kiddie, but when it comes to like anything else, like I'm not even that. I have a basic understanding of how these things work, so I'm trying to get to the point where I know just enough that I can actually test these things out and make something happen, but not quite there yet, and it takes a lot of time, and I just haven't had it.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of knowledge is sometimes obtained through deconstruction or reverse engineering, as some people might refer to it, of something that's already been done. Like, for instance, I, for a while, was really big into PHP Nuke websites. I loved them. I just was so cool and so much different than the standard HTML that I was used to messing with at that time. But I, of course, again, had the same kind of learning curve that you're talking about right now. I could only draw from websites and stuff and the information that's out there. And, I mean, let's just face it. Most of the time when something becomes an oral tradition, there's a certain level of it that you have to be inducted to. And that induction is often not openly offered. You know, they kind of hold the tricks of their trade to themselves, so to speak.
Right. And, you know, and that's, I think that's another problem with our education system is that we don't have that level of interaction. You know, it's as automated as it possibly can get, you know, applying the Ford analogy again. You know, we have our school system set up like a fucking assembly line. We stick people in a room and try to drill them full of information and stick them out there, and it's just not very effective, and people aren't engaged. I guess in another episode, they were talking about how the European system, they do it a little bit differently, and I don't know how effective it is, but early on they try to find people's what they're good at. But then again, that comes back to the whole specialization idea, and we know that Europe is having major issues right now. I don't know if it's related to that, but still.
It could be vastly drawn that it is related, even if it's only by some remote factor. You know, what you develop over time in culture are traditions, but not just traditions, but standards of practice. And so that standard of practice typically tends to seep beyond its initially intended target matter. One thing I can make a good example of is in the world of business, sometime in the 80s, one of these business philosophers got the idea that Sun Tzu's Art of War would actually be an excellent business guide. And so you see something that was meant in a militant fashion surfacing into something else that isn't necessarily militant in nature. I mean, the overall objective is the same, to get more or to win, but the process and the actual focus of it is completely different.
Yeah, it does work, though. You do have to adapt it.
Yeah, yes. The adaption, though, is that's not necessarily a bad thing. What I was kind of getting at was that we get locked inside of that box when we start to do things like that. Yeah.
You get locked in the box of I'm sorry, I'm kind of lost for a second.
Right. Well, you might be hanging in the Church of Phallic Worship at the moment, so.
No, I just kind of lost the. Like, you were talking about taking Sun Tzu and applying it to business, and they get locked in this box.
Yeah,
where I got lost.
The thrust is that once you begin, okay, you say, all right, the ideas of Sun Tzu's art are not just applicable to business, but now we can also say that they're applicable to the kitchen somehow. Let's say cooking.
Oh, I see.
You found a way.
Yeah, not everything is transferable.
Well, it's not even that it's not transferable. What happens is that you have found this particular philosophy, this particular structure or method of doing things, and you think that it's notable or it makes a big difference, and so you try to apply it and transfer it to all things. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, the trap is trying to do it, take it way too far.
Right, or the trap is actually in thinking that just because Sun Tzu's philosophy works well for war and it works well for a business, that it's going to work well in the kitchen. When something like, I'm trying to think of another correlation, something like Eskimo fishing may have a philosophy that's better suited for the kitchen.
Ah, gotcha. So it takes, so the trap is not being able to realize that, or not necessarily that, but it's thinking that you can take those ideas and move them somewhere else. So it makes me wonder how many people fall into that trap where they have a certain ideology and they think they can apply it to other things. And, you know, I think some philosophies you can take and give them new forms, but I don't know if you can give them all forms.
And I think that, and even if you could give them all forms, even if it did hold a constant rule all the way across, that doesn't mean that there is not another philosophy that is better suited for a particular form.
Right.
I think
that
makes
sense.
The overall gist. Yeah.
So while you can move it, so while you can give it a new form, there may be a better core idea for that particular form than what you're trying to impose on it or trying to mold.
Right. I mean, you wouldn't take the Briggs-Myers personality philosophy and apply it to, I don't know, micro sciences, because
that would make any.
You might come up with something cool, but what you'll more times than not find is that there are microsciences, there are philosophies in microscience already that are more adept to suiting it.
That's probably very true. Like you were saying, all the science has its own philosophy. So, yeah, Myers-Briggs wouldn't work well there. It would work well with marketing, as I've talked about before, with persona architecture and all that good stuff. But it wouldn't, That's kind of funny.
It's the whole one ring to rule them all paradox.
I think that might be one reason people like to find a niche, because it's hard to actually find forms for something when you're trying to bring something over. And, I mean, it can be very effective, but like you were saying, it's not meant to be. There's no one ring to rule them all approach. So I think sometimes people just say, fuck it, I'm just going to go niche on this.
Right. Well, I mean, you see failures and attempts to do that all the time. The one ring to rule them all thing. And I just personally have always thought it was fascinating, because I wonder why they don't open their mind a little bit and consider alternative methods to each form.
Right. I guess you kind of see that with Christianity now trying to impose I guess in the U.S., Christianity is trying to win ring. I guess that's kind of how they're built, though. I guess some philosophies are built to think that, excuse me, I thought that are built to give people the impression that it is applicable to everything.
Well, that's precisely the point that I'm kind of getting at, is that they're not applicable to everything. And they only work within a certain set of parameters, and then beyond that, you may have a mild level of success, but you might ultimately be missing that one core thing, whatever that one core thing is.
Yeah, it is limited.
That would have been, yeah. So, well, shit. For open discussion, I think this went pretty well.
Yep, with no topic at hand.
None. I do like the idea of oral traditions. I like the idea of apprenticeships. I don't like the idea that there should be some kind of structured, dogmatic, I'm trying to think, adherence to your apprenticeship. Let's say if you're a tattoo artist and you're studying under one particular guy, and you happen to notice another guy who has a particular style that is intriguing to you, there's nothing wrong with picking up the techniques that he has developed. You know, you don't have to stay a traditionalist in that aspect.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, when you're teaching somebody, you want them to be flexible, because at some point you got to let them go and do their own thing. And if they only know what you know, then they're not going to get very far, because you're already doing that. And for all you know, maybe you've trained other people that are doing the same thing. So now they're all competing with each other with the same thing, and probably won't get very far. So when you kick someone out of the nest, they need to be prepared to do their own thing. Didn't Gurdjieff kind of do that kind of thing with people he was teaching? He'd kick them out of the nest because they, you know, everything happened. I don't know exactly why, but I get the impression that he took them as far as he could, and there was really no point in teaching anymore, so he had to kick them out of the nest because they were kind of clinging to him.
Right. Well, that is very fairly deciphered as what happened, I think it's just a little short of the complete understanding of it, and that is that the first thing to understand is that Gurdjieff was very anti, I want to say faith or tradition or dogma. He was more concerned about the actual idea themselves. I did a piece a while ago on the Cult of Cthulhu where I talked about and having an idea without dogma.
I remember that
was very much. Yeah, that was very much the perspective that Gurdjieff was coming from. So what was happening was that they were taking this general idea that Gurdjieff was putting forward and trying to make it more rigid and structured.
What do you mean, like
than it was intended?
What's that? Kind of like what Ouspensky did?
that's precisely what Ouspensky did. Ouspensky tried to systematize something that Gurdjieff felt was an organic understanding and not a system. So this is this is where the fundamental problem came and why he kicked them out. He hoped by kicking them out that they would ultimately come to the conclusion that they're trying to systematize something that was meant in a more organic fashion. Indeed, was kind of their downfall. He hoped that their own experience, their own praxis, would in fact reveal to them where their, you know, the downfalls were of not adopting other ways of thinking.
Yep, and I think people get, and like I guess we were saying before, is a lot of people nowadays are falling into that same trap. It's kind of like children that can't grow up. We live in a society of a bunch of grown children that they need to be told what to do. They have a hard time with original thought. They can't figure things out on their own. Sometimes it takes, people are scared of failing so much because they've been protected for so long. But the people who succeed the most tend to go through a lot of failure.
Exactly. You have to have that period of descent. You have to find out. One of the things that I like to talk about often is what is referred to by Peer Grimes as the Buddha mind. I myself am not a Buddhist, so this is a third-party interpretation. But the way that it is explained is that moment of realization that whatever it is that you're looking upon is not you, that you are in fact separate from that. And in doing that, you've dissented from the idea. You've created a separation. And it's ultimately that separation that leads to higher understanding.
Yep. I just keep thinking of that Tyler Durden thing. You are not your job.
Yeah, you are not your fucking khakis. You are not the contents of your wallet. Yeah, that whole thing.
That's along the same thing.
That's precisely it, man. I mean, without a doubt, that's it. When you realize that you're not your ideas, you're not any of those things, that they are all malleable and fluid and they are meant to remain as such, then you reach a different level of understanding in the world. You know, that nothing is written in stone, so to speak. I mean, even stuff that's written in stone isn't necessarily permanent and forever, although that particular analogy is meant to demonstrate that. We all know that you can, you know, take rock sandpaper and sand off whatever was etched on it.
Yep.
Or you can smash it with a hammer.
It's kind of like the idea of the first premise is like when you look at any like logical argument in science or philosophy or whatever, you always come back to what's the first premise upon all of this and is it valid? And what you come into is these circular arguments. So when you're talking about even when you find the stone, you can still change it. Yeah, things are not as concrete as we like to believe. I mean, I think things are. I kind of like Dee's way of thinking about it. It's like when we talk about that being a causal universe or deterministic, he uses the word probabilistic. Things have a tendency to go a certain way, but not always. I mean, we can get pretty close, but not quite there. No cigar.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing we were actually discussing last night. It's something I like to call the variable factor. And the variable factor has a couple of very interesting characteristics to it, and that is that there is a point, a density point in a cloud, and I'm just going to use this as an example, and this is when it becomes saturated with water enough to release water and rain. That density point is when it typically happens, but it's not always the case.
Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they rain before. Yeah. Or sometimes they hold on to it longer.
Sometimes they hold on to it longer. Sometimes they rain before. Sometimes it just dissipates. It's all variable. And it's something that I don't think that we ever account for, especially when we're determining the proximity of origin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't account for the fact that the further away from you you move, the more that variable factor is also inactive.
Mm-hmm.
The further something is from you, the more unpredictable it is.
We should bring this back to your chili, because when you're cooking your chili, you could have a recipe that tells you how to do it, but it's not going to turn out the same every time. And so when you're doing it based off experience, you can get it how you want by knowing just how it behaves, but it's not going to cook the same every time if you follow the recipe.
Right on, which is, I guess, one way I could say fuck you to Chef Ramsay.
Say what?
It's one way I could say fuck you to Chef Ramsay. I was just making it.
Yeah. Yeah, that guy's a dick.
Yeah. Well, no, I actually like the fact that he's a dick. I don't like the fact that he thinks that that something is going to taste the exact same way every time you make it.
Yeah, you have a good point there. Yeah, I don't really watch TV, but when I did watch that show a little bit, and I like his attitude, but yeah, he expects things to turn, it's kind of like the unofficial definition of insanity is doing the same thing, the same way every time I don't know if that ties in quite well.
That's actually the reverse of what we're talking about.
Yeah, that is.
The same thing,
yeah,
expecting
about the,
different results.
Yeah, I was actually, I stopped myself because... kind of crunchy.
Now, I don't know how accurate it is, but Jason Sorrell often offers a different definition of what sanity was, initially developed as. Sanity, as he has offered it to be, is drawn from the word sanguine, which means royalty or something like that. And so it's the king's way of doing it or the king's way of thinking.
Uh-huh.
And that in itself makes you wonder then, if that's the case, is it important to be sane?
From a societal standpoint, to function, to be regarded as sane is helpful if you want to work within society. It's kind of how it is right now, too. If you look at our psychology text now, things that go outside the norm are what are insane. And to a point, I think some diagnoses are just bullshit because of that. I'm not going to say that all diagnoses for all conditions are bullshit. I mean, most of them are just descriptions anyway, but when you actually go get diagnosed with a disorder, it has to do with your functionality in society. I mean, you can live your whole life with certain symptoms and never get diagnosed because you're fine with the way you are. You know, you're not worried about all those other things. But when you're in a society where you have certain thoughts, behaviors, emotions that don't fit within that, then you go see a doctor and say, I'm distressed over this, and they'll diagnose you. That's supposed to be how it works. But yeah, a lot of those diagnoses come from the structure of the society. So, yeah, it kind of still is the way you were describing, except without a monarchy, I suppose. The structure is the same idea.
Same essence, different form.
Yeah,
absolutely. And that in itself makes me wonder the relevance of insanity or sanity altogether, other than from the model of the social structure.
Yep. Although
I think that the... Go ahead, Leon.
I was just going to restate that some diagnoses, you know, there are some conditions that you can't function as a human being at all. Versus society, like some forms of schizophrenia or genetic disorders, like what was it called, Down syndrome, and probably some others, but I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, what were you saying?
I was just going to ultimately say that I thought your example with the diagnosis was a salient.
That what?
I'm sorry, my phone's not going now. I'm trying to get back to where it won't do that. There we go. What I was saying was I thought that your example using the medical diagnosis is to illustrate the sanity point was the same, and I thought it was very sharp.
Thank you.
And with all that being said, man, there's roughly about 3.5 minutes left in the show, so it's time to put our plugs. Well, first, maybe we'll talk about what we're doing next week. I'm wondering if it's not a good idea with the holiday season in, if it's not a good idea to kind of take a break from the general more rigid study that we've been doing here on this particular show and stay in more of an open discussion format, given that people...
That would be easier on me, sure.
Yeah. I mean, I know that this is a busy time of year for everybody, and whether you celebrate these holidays or not, 9 times out of 10, you got a job that's directly related to them.
Yep.
So... people don't have the time to really pick up the books we're talking about at this point in time. So I'm thinking until after the New Year's passed, we're kind of conclude the more rigid study and stick with something more like this open discussion format.
Sounds good to me.
And so, and on that note, I guess I should throw out a couple of plugs. Here, I wanted to first plug SatanicInternationalNetwork.com. Now I think it's at like close to 3,000 members.
I think so, yeah.
That's awesome. I want to plug EminentMind.info, EntropicMomentum.com. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah, EntropicMomentum.com. And I guess beyond that, I could plug everybody else's stuff, but what I'll say rather than that is if you go to the oozeradio.wordpress.com website, there is a link section that's packed full of all kinds of good stuff. I recommend checking out every one of those links, everything from the Autodiabolic Method to L316, our Order of Nine Angles.net, CreativeOddityStudios.com. You'll find links for that there. I just think that it's better to point them all there and say click those links.
Yep. Yeah. If you care to go to these websites, they have all the links you need. Keep digging down the rabbit hole.
Yep. Yep. And on that note, man, we can play the outro. You can hang out with your friend, and we'll talk to everybody next week.
All right. You have a good weekend.